Hey folks, thanks for joining us again. This is episode 2 of our summer series with Martin out, where it'll just be me and a DAO operator, DAO founder, or otherwise Web3 involved person having a quick conversation. So today's conversation is going to be with Jeremy Akers. He is a super talented facilitator and organizer who is going to walk through the best practices for DAOs, from liberating structures, what he's building across the DAO ecosystem, and what you can learn in terms of patterns that already exist inside of agile frameworks and other practices that if you're looking to start a DAO or if you're looking to basically increase the operational efficiency and competency of your current DAO, you'll have plenty to learn from. So thanks for joining us and enjoy the episode. And please remember to rate us and subscribe. Thank you. Hey, Jeremy. Thanks for joining us today.
What's up, Jahed? Thanks for having me, man.
Well, we like to kick things off usually by just asking you to tell us a bit about your story. Start wherever you like. What's the story of Jeremy?
I mean, I don't know, man. I'm just a fucking dude. I grew up in the West Coast in the mountains and across the water from Seattle, Washington, Pacific Northwest. I spent some time in LA, and then I moved out to the Netherlands in 2009 when I met a beautiful girl and like decided to rush headlong into the unknown with very little certainty and security and just nice. See how things went. And was around there for 6 years and decided let's chill and stay. And now I'm dad. I have fatherhood for 2 kids named Isaiah and Lumen that are the raddest.
Same here.
To a human
just one.
Named Sarah.
Awesome. And so, and then on the, I guess, I hate this word, like the professional Jeremy, but really more like, tell us a little bit about the story of your work. What's the kind of work you've been doing over all these years?
Word, the shit I've been up to, for real. I started off in sales and account management because I realized I could like make a living by talking to people. And like, that was just, yeah, I can do that. I can do that now. I don't have to go to school to do that. And then at some point I bumped into a startup and was like guy 6 in the room. And we were trying to build a product around anti-piracy software of all things. And that's the day I discovered product development and that it's way easier to like build things that people want than it is to try and hustle people into something that they don't really fucking need. And so
absolutely.
Yeah. And so that was a lot of fun. It was a real big learning experience and whatnot. But since I don't really do this technical thing, I do more of this blah, blah, blah thing. I figured that I could be of service to that purpose of building things that are worthy through the sort of like scrum mastership and facilitation route. So I'm sort of like, I do my best to like set the vibe and to hold on to a line of inquiry that leads us towards productive outcomes. But at the end of the day, it's just about like trying to skew the playing field so that like we can hit it more or less a hole in the one. And a hole in the one. I don't know how that game works, but
no golf metaphors, but it's fine because you don't know it works, which is perfect, right? So it works out by my rules. I've literally just established on this call my anti-golf rules. But anyway, so that's interesting. You've been doing scrum master type work facilitation. I think that for folks who are not at all involved in technology, they're like, what in the hell is a scrum? Like, that sounds like a rugby term. So can you tell us a little bit about what that is and what facilitation as a person in that context is?
I mean, so I'm just going to try and keep it super high level. So there's this thing called the Agile Manifesto. It's bad as a motherfucker, right? Where we prioritize individuals and interactions over processes and tools, working solutions over extensive documentation, customer collaboration over contract negotiation, and responding to change over following a fixed plan.
By the way, you're one of the only people who's probably been able to just, I mean, that page hasn't changed in like 30 years. So you recited all of it from memory. That's just nice.
It's just there, man. It's just there. And so like, that's super abstract maybe for some people. Like, what does that mean? And there's a bit of a paradox and a wink in there, right? It basically means like, individuals and interactions, we prioritize that over processes and tools. And I might rip that open and tear it to shreds to make it more legible, which means we only want to pick processes and tools that act in the service of individual and interactions. And if we can do that, we will tear it up.
We are, you know, we are about to go on like a huge tangent, but like, I'm gonna try to stop us. But basically, one of the things I had a 10-year career in product management. And so every product person sidles into that product owner role. And first of all, the fact that there are roles in Agile drives me nuts. And I hate how there's certifications and like titles and these rituals and processes. I'm like, this is nonsense. This is not at all the spirit of what Agile first was. And now it's this really weird thing with, you know, you can't see our video, but I'm making all these essentially, you know, little gestures and witchcraft, but nothing actually, witchcraft is actually useful. Let's not even apply that to, you know, Agile. But like,
It's become a lot about like cover my ass bullshit. And absolutely. Like, say that you've checked the box and not checked it. Not have any concern at all about what checking the box means or how you actually check the box well with care, right?
Yep. So if I remix a bit of what you said, essentially you spent, you know, quite a bit of your life thinking about how humans should work together, how they should value and prioritize the things that are out there that they could do together, and then make decisions about how to kind of ship those things together and stay on the same page.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I would look at it as like one big catch-all of like, I host the dialogue that allows us to answer to discover questions and to answer them.
Perfect. And
that can encapsulate a lot of things.
Cool. And then, so how did you end up, you know, I think now you're kind of involved with a couple of things, Token Engineering Commons, possibly Common Stack, I don't recall, but Gravity DAO. How did you end up in this this whirlwind chaotic space that we all share in Web3?
Exactly. To the maelstrom, where the eye of the storm, with regions unite. Well, that came via the specific toolkit that I've used to sort of blaze a path through whatever we're talking about, this career thing, and that's liberating structures. So contrary to like the certification route, liberating structures are an open source or a toolkit or repertoire of 33 different sort of really super stripped down, simple facilitation techniques that my five-year-old can literally learn how to use. And when we stack those, and I basically have a hypothesis, and that is your DAO needs liberating structures. And that is, if you're going to try and decentralize agency, decision-making, and action, then it helps to have a tool that helps distribute cognition and create little hive minds that help you come to those complex decision points of immense uncertainty that we have to discover together.
Got it. And so that's a great space to dig into. I know like you don't just jump in and, you know, learn. Of course, it's simple. Like you said, you're simple enough that your five-year-old could begin to facilitate interactions between themselves and their friends, right? But basically, tell us a bit more about liberating structures itself. How did you become aware of it? How did it play a hand in your background?
Sure. So when I started, and I made a pivot from product development, from sales into scrum mastership. And at some point I had been doing my scrum mastership long enough on paper that meant I was a real badass scrum master, even though I was just a dude on a team trying to help us solve for whatever the fuck. And so somebody decided, hey, you'd make a great agile coach. And I don't really know what that meant. And so they pulled me into a wild adventure. I got to hang out with a name drop, Ari Van Denikum, one of the co-authors of the Agile Manifesto, for a good hot second.
Awesome.
And they threw me at cross environment, sort of like coaching and enablement. And I had no fucking clue how to do that shit because I was always just a guy on a team. And so I was like drowning, and like people are standing there, like looking at me, asking questions and going, what should we do? And I have no idea. And they don't like that answer either, right?
Yeah. So
I found liberating structures like a man that was drowning, and it gave me a cogent way to say, well, I don't have the answers to these questions, but I can help us find the questions. And I can give us a structured step-by-step process that can help us come to answers together in a pretty straightforward way. And that sort of return on time invested just has an incredible vibe when you can like increase the flow of energy and information. Like, that's all right. You can look at time and it can just fly by in a sort of flow state.
Yeah, that's kind of the key thing. I've always heard about it as well. Can you tell us a bit, you know, you mentioned it in passing, but there's like there's 33 methods there. It's a way to facilitate things. You yourself found it when you were drowning as an Agile coach. What was it about liberating? How do you describe liberating structures to other people? And how do it, where do people go to actually learn about it? What's the kind of first piece when you say, hey, Jeremy, what is liberating structures? And you're like,
well, liberating structures have this unfortunate quality that they're much easier to experience than they are to explain. It's way easier to like put people in an experience of liberating structures and then go, all right, how's this stuff work and feel? And how might you use it than it is to like sit here and jaw on about it.
Yeah.
But liberating structures are basically a set of interaction patterns. They have three core design elements, which is how participation is distributed with the expectation that it should be pretty much everywhere, how groups are formed with an expectation that they should be small, and a sort of algorithmic nature of a set of steps over time. So how participation is distributed, how groups are formed, set of steps over time, you start getting into these sort of like dance-like interaction patterns. Mm-hmm. The first of which I might always encourage everybody to learn is 1-2-4-all. You know, ask a question into a group, take a minute to stop and think about it, gather your thoughts, have a brief one-on-one dialogue with somebody else about it, and then find another pair to exchange ideas. Now you can do that other pair thing exceptionally awesomely, where instead of regurgitating your own thoughts, you can try and paraphrase your partner and tell and synthesize the information they gave, give them the opportunity to also clarify and double click on any of the good shit. But anyway, you do that in a group of four, and then you upregulate the most salient portion of your conversation to the whole group. And that takes about 15 minutes. Just try it like four times in an hour, you know, split up your next phone call and just make everything a question and go through 1-2-4-all and see what it feels like.
Yeah. And that's on, if you're listening, you're like, what is he talking about? Where do I read more about this? Libertyingstructures.com has all of these. You can basically scroll through halfway down the page. There's this nifty little section that has all 33 structures on a nice little card. You click on them, you dig in, they give you an example. It's quite nice.
For sure.
And it's actually, you know, something I've pointed a lot of my, you know, people who ask me in Dallas, they're like, what do? I have this problem. Like, you know, let's go through it together. Let's pick one or a menu of them that you think can maybe address the problem. And that's kind of one way. And also it was inspiration for, if you saw a few weeks ago, Jeremy, the Gnosis Guild launched a little Tao pattern wiki in the spirit of Christopher Alexander's patterns.
Yep.
And so honestly, I borrowed heavily from Liberating Structures and cited it as well. Cause I was like, you should just go look at this, right?
Like, exactly. It's there. Like, yeah. So this kind of gets into the play. The reason I think of these things belong in Web3. So I think these are common goods, right? I can imagine no greater public good than helping everybody learn, practice, and use liberating structures to help address complex life stuff with each other. It's just, it's a no-brainer. It upgrades everybody's agency together.
So upgrading agency is a really good way to put it, because I think that that's one of the main things that, for me at least, why I really got involved in DAOs is that as an anarchist, I believe that one of the main, you know, pillars of what we believe in is agency maximization for all organisms, not just humans, right?
Totally.
Of course, there's a little bit of, you know, there are some types who are like, well, I don't care about animals. There are other ones, whatever. But that's basically like, that's my perspective on it. And so when we talk about upgrading agency, I think it's one of the visions that people want to achieve with this space. But we're very, very far from it, in my opinion, just because we've been distracted by a token go up and these other things, right? And but the hope for me has always been that and I think your experience as Scrum Master is really important, actually, for this. It's really interesting. I'd love to hear what you think about this. I have always said that DAOs, the big opportunity for DAOs is that they have the ability to actually execute in a full-throated and authentic manner all of the things that corporates kind of say they want to do with respect to like vision and mission and having everyone bought in equally and this, that, and the other. It kind of falls apart pretty quickly when you realize that your manager or the executive for your division has 100 times the equity you do and upside. So like, why would you do that? Right. So to get to an actual question here, I think let's talk a little bit about this upgrading agency, right? Because it takes a lot of different forms. It takes basically, in my experience, this, you know, the power differentials in traditional workplaces lead to like, are part of the reason why you have disengagement, right? In my opinion. And so if you agree with that or want to spar with me on that opinion, I'm curious to hear, how does liberating structures get in your experience, how does it get people engaged? How does it upgrade their agency?
So there's a question behind the question that eludes me. That really has more to do about why we fuck up.
Yeah.
And I mean, you evoke the power differentials for sure. That is a part of it. But I think there's just an enormous space that is cognitive bias, that is brain don't work so good under limited conditions.
Yeah.
And one of the ways we can get pulled into those things individually, but we also get pulled into cognitive biases and shitty patterns collectively as well. So what liberating structures offer is like a functional pattern that the group can then entrain and embody into. So rather than like, here's an idea, here's some conceptual information, liberating structures are procedures that you can just pick up. They're a collection of psychotechnologies. If you hang out with the Verveke and those nerds, you know, they are collective psychotechnologies that help us actively design and engage in collective metacognition, right? So this idea of process mindfulness, where we can get into a space where we all have enough fluency about the flows of interaction, where we can have a discussion about how we want to think about the thing before we go thinking about the thing. And the way we set up how we think about the thing can increase the probability that we just crush that objective.
Yes.
Like, if you think about your agenda for a meeting, you probably have like five different tasks that have very different outcomes that they want. Some wants to go out, gather information. Some wants to make a decision. Some wants to set up questions and explore constraint space. Some want to look temporally forward. Some want to look temporally backward. So instead of using the five like Stone Age meeting tools, like presentation, group discussion, status update, brainstorm, or goat rodeo, the unstructured group discussion, you can pick an appropriate tool for the needs of that particular topic and then just like consistently start to crush these things. And then, like I said, step-by-step process for any big question.
Yeah, I think this is great. And it really, really brings to the fore for me what this agency maximization or upgrading agency actually looks like, because I feel that, you know, you just mapped out a meeting structure that most people would be familiar with if they have a white collar job in one of these Western countries, or even in, you know, Singapore or, you know, parts of Nigeria, et cetera. Mm-hmm. There are, this work culture has proliferated and most people are kind of familiar with that. Let's do our check-in, let's do this, that, and the other. And there's probably a manager who comes in and structures it this way. And really the key insight I've seen from liberating structures is that it offers a way for you to say, well, if we didn't have someone telling us what to do all the time, how would we structure this? Right. And I think that, and then it's like you said, it's a question behind the question. So it's, you know, how would we structure this? How should we structure it based on what are we trying to get out of this?
Exactly. Right? And then once you have a repertoire, you can actually answer that question. Right. And just the exploration of the question is already like an infinite win to make any decision rather than to just roll on autopilot. Already just like puts you head and shoulders above the competition, so to speak, if you want to look at it from a scarcity perspective.
Yep.
But I mean, it just allows you to like look over the landscape as you're traveling it in a way that's pretty special.
And so
you can do that. And one of the key features about liberating structures is since we distribute participation everywhere and we split people into small groups, that we include and unleash literally everyone in participating in the conversation. If it's just you and one other person in a breakout space, we've increased the throughput or the exchange of energy and information by orders of magnitude, depending on the size of the room, right? If instead of everybody sitting here and listening to me talk, they were interacting with each other, like the surface area of thought is just exploding. And then the flow of information just goes way up, even though your bandwidth, you know, the brains in the room is stable, right?
You're giving me some ideas for my Shelling Point talk right now, actually, because Shelling Point is moving to, they really want to do more unconference type facilitation and workshops. And this would just, I could literally just turn the existing themes I have into a liberating structures, actually.
Amen. That's the game.
Yeah. You want to stay in this room, you know, it's really for this. And, you know, you don't have to leave. You could choose, of course, this is an unconference. You vote with your feet. These are the themes I was thinking of talking about. What do y'all think? We facilitate that. Then we can choose which of the liberating structures we want to get into that we think will get us to where we want to be at the end of the 45 minutes. Then we decide what to do with it. That could be very fun, actually.
It's sick as shit. I mean, it's a lived, agile, embodied experience, right? It's not like a bullshit training. It's like, hey, we're going to actually do the thing on the spot right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a good little segue into, so you have LS DAO, you're involved with Token Engineering Commons. How have you been using liberating structures within DAOs and, you know, this Web3 context?
Yeah, so I'm really exploring that opportunity that, like I said, all DAOs need to learn liberating structures. I started off with Gravity DAO within the Token Engineering Commons just because their transparency is fucking mind-blowing. With all the calls uploaded on YouTube, just enabled me to like literally watch the whole community for like a hot second, like decide which working groups were the place. And then I just walked in and said, okay, I belong in Gravity. This is where the work I'm doing makes the most sense. Since what Gravity DAO is doing is sort of satisfying Eleanor Ostrom's principle around making sure that there's dispute resolution available. You know, I'm helping to, you know, do the bad work of creep scope, because I think dispute resolution is awesome, but let's build trust at the same time to prevent it.
Well, absolutely. I think like the dispute resolution thing is very important because, you know, it depends on what level of society and interaction you're talking about, but dispute resolution doesn't really exist I guess you'd say, basically what I'm trying to say is the police are not conflict resolution.
All right. All those tokens, my wallet.
Like, you need to have some other way of saying, how do we deal with this? How do we decide what damage has been done? How do we make a person or a group of people whole? And how do we, if we want to, have a route to, you know, either rehabilitation or reinclusion for the people who have
messy work. The messy work that is reconciliation.
Yeah, because you can't just, that's one of the things, right? It's for what I always say to people when they're like, oh, you're an anarchist, you don't believe in laws. And I'm like, no, because we're really just actually outsourcing our own responsibility to laws and hoping for the best, right? And so, and we've seen what that does, mass incarceration, destroying families and communities, not victims, not actually even being addressed. Exactly. So I would like to see something that even victims would say, you know, I feel better about this.
Totally. And so that's kind of the work of like space convening, right? Just to provide context for people to get their story out and feel like they've been seen and heard.
And I totally hijacked you, by the way, going back to the DAO context. So totally getting back on that front, how have you been taking some of these in the dispute resolution section of what you're doing?
Yeah.
I'm fascinated. Would love to hear how you're enacting this within DAOs.
For sure. So right now the idea is about distribute the tooling and make them available to people, right? Since we're sort of starting off on the very, very beginning, the sort of jet phase that is gestation, like everybody his ability to use, practice, and learn liberating structures is sort of capped by their ability to get out of this phase of gestation and come into an active phase of birth. So right now the work is mostly about getting the tools in front of people, hosting practice groups and getting them hands-on experience to increase the possibility that they might be able to use these tools in other contexts.
Got it. And who are some of the DAOs that you've been working with on this?
Yeah, so there's Gravity in the Token Engineering Commons. There's Aragon hosting a whole bunch of like in-person action and community support work through the ReFi DAO and Regions Unite, of course. That's my native squad, you know. We're trying to put together an exceptional relational field so that, you know, we can just have very, very fertile ground to sort of plant some seeds, you know, and exchange, you know, care, insight, you know, hopefully wisdom together.
And so before we jump off the dispute resolution topic too, this is a tool for intra-dispute resolution, inter-dispute resolution, or both?
So the way I would look at it is what we're trying to do with liberating structures is actually increase the sort of lubrication of communication, right? So to give everybody like, by using a liberating structure, I can give everybody like an area of effect upgrade, like an enchantment on communication skill due to the structure. And so that context helps carry the load to get information that normally doesn't have an opportunity to see the time of day, to get that out and sort of on the table so that we can start to wrestle with it. There are some particular structures that are really great for specific sort of interventional work in terms of dispute resolution. The eco cycle is always phenomenal, but the most accessible, I would say, is liberating structures. You know, in most dispute resolution situations, we're looking for, you know, if we turn things into a zero-sum game and how is it that A or Z? So if we can put those into some form of paradoxical relationship through the use of a wicked question, which is how is it that we both A and Z at the same time? And that just opens us up to a whole nother layer of complexity and nuance that has to integrate both needs and desires. And so that's something that you can use individually as a group to help understand your situation, but it definitely helps in the space of like either or thinking to really cut through that and go, oh, no, really, yes, and how is it that we respect what you care and appreciate while also not abandoning the values and principles of a counterpart? Like, what if we can take both of these things really seriously and how to hold them into a creative tension together rather than destructive.
Got it. And I think, like, you know, when people look at this and say, hey, well, I'll give you an example too. And Prime, I run marketing with a really talented, amazing group of folks here. And I used to, like, I say it, you know, I say running marketing, so I go, what do you do there? I'm like, I run marketing. But honestly, it's at this point, I'm completely secondary to it. Like, I still actually produce a lot of our stuff. I write things, I write the articles, I write a lot of our deeper dives, but the team behind it that's in charge of, like, who needs to see it? Where do we get it to? How do we do it? Like, people come in like, how do you guys do this without anyone going, you need to do this, right? And I think that's the key thing for people who are out there going, what is this whole DAO thing about and how does it work? It's like, well, when someone tells you that, it turns out you don't need someone else to tell you what to do. That's not the first time you knew that, right? Like, you already knew that, right?
Exactly. So then, if you can find it, there's a little portion of you that's really pissed off about people telling you what to do, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You already knew this. And then when you wake up to it and you go, wait, I already knew this. How do we decide what to do now, right? And for me, that's really where I think when I've turned to LS, that's really what's helped us, you know, kind of get going, is to say, well, what is the real structure of the problem that we, do we all agree that a problem exists? Great. Which one, let's pick a pattern that we'd actually use to address this. Did it actually get us there or not? We do it again. And this is the stuff, this is the hard work of actually organizing ourselves, right? Because it's easy and often quite wrong for someone to come in and say, well, you know, I've had all the important conversations. You just need to do this or shut the
what
fuck up.
What you need to do is. Yeah,
exactly. And in my experience so far, it ends up being more correct, or at least correct more often, less of a, more of a hit rate if you actually do it this way. Mm-hmm. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah. I mean, there's a challenge that, you know, we're all sort of like, greedy, stupid, and short-sighted, and like our thinking with all of these biases again. And we think that like we are dealing with regular problems that you can just move directly to. And sometimes we are, like, you can just like see a thing and know a thing and then move immediately in that direction. And then like, yay, dopamine. But for a lot of situations, like, we run into obstacles, like moving immediately towards the intended solution might lead you to a dead end, which you're going to have to back up and retrace your steps and move around to get to. So then having a way to that can help you do that in a way that feels like sort of both elegant, like stupid simple, and fucking fun, like, really just lightens up the, like, the old performance anxiety. Like, it just becomes a different thing when we are just like forming a distributed cognition that is handling the situation, and that your information and my information are helping us all to re-aspectualize and upgrade a higher resolution map of the relevance relationship with everything.
I think that's spot on, because I think that, like, this is really one of the things that it led me to decentralized organizing and distributed ownership, is that we essentially, it's almost like a computational complexity or information or information theoretic problem, where it's like, hey, and it's funny, I'll put this in the show notes too, but I love kind of where this has come out in recent years. There are folks like you know, people are like, oh, why are you an anarchist? Do you hate cops and, you know, all that and the other? And I'm like, well, first of all, I'm not going to answer that question. Who are you, a cop? But second of all, no, there are valid computational complexity, information theoretic, and ethical arguments for it. But I think the ones that come are kind of aligned with what you're saying, which is that there's a fellow, Dr. Yanir Baryam, who's out at the New England Complexity Institute, NECSI, and a Complexity Science Institute. And every few years, every 2 or 3 years, he'll release a new paper. He's not an anarchist, but he studies political anarchism. He studies hierarchy, studies information flow through organizations. And he published a really great paper, which I'll put in the show notes. It's I believe it was The Inherent Disorder of organizational complexity or something like that. But the key insight of it was basically that once you begin to put management hierarchies in place, basically is like, yes, these do help you make decisions and they do help you kind of, you know, move faster, as you say, but a lot of the computational richness of decision making is lost, and you're not able to explore the entire space of opportunities as an organization because of that. And one of the major things that, you know, when you talk about cognition, upgrading our cognition, I believe that's basically an argument for that. If you can get more people to become more involved, to open up, to understand and become engaged and understand that they have a lot of value to provide for this thing that we're building together, and then you give them a way to channel that, you're going to have a more complex organization, and that's actually good.
Yeah. Surprise. Yeah. And it looks a little messier from the outside, right? Because it's grappling with a different dimensionality in terms of complexity. Like, it's got all of this breadth and all of this depth. And that might look like at the core of this beast, it's not going very fast. Like, it might look like you're spending an enormous amount of time on building the relational substrate, the soil of our interactions and trust, so that we can continue to like open ourselves up and expose our vulnerabilities to greater and greater degrees together, so that, you know, we can build trust as we go. And so if you can do that, then like things continuously get sort of easier and easier and easier, but it takes a good amount of time of like investment into that shit. And the funny part is not all, it takes a continuous reinvestment of that time in relationship. It can't just be like, oh yeah, we took the time that we did our offsite, we came together, we cried, we hugged, and then we're good now, chest bump and go on and do your thing. Like, no, like you're going to have to like every now and then, you know, on a cyclical basis, ideally, you know, ritualistically, like, you know, go to the parish, you know, go to church, man.
Exactly. You know? And I think that's a really good point, because basically, like, I just remembered the name of this paper, by the way. It's The Inherent Instability of Disordered Systems. And one of the things, and just giving, I really don't want to lose this track on cognition and complexity. It's really interesting, because essentially, you'll see a few folks in Web3 talk about this, where they're talking about, you know, organizational cybernetics, management cybernetics, etc. But one of the key insights from that, which I think feeds right into liberating structures, is essentially that the law of requisite variety essentially states that the variation in an environment. Ashby. Yeah, exactly. Ross Ashby back in the day, right? And basically, in a super simple way, not to get into any of the math, it's basically that the variation in an environment, in order to deal with it, you have to have at least as much variational states, the internal state of the governor that has to actually go through that environment. So if you think about it as a management hierarchy or an organization, what you're essentially doing is saying that guy is going to make all the decisions, and you're hoping that they can build an organization as complex as is necessary to navigate a business landscape or a supply chain.
Individual circuits,
exactly. Right? And the way we manage it is we go, let's put more people in direct, I'm going to hire more directors, director there, director here, director there, director there. They're going to handle the complexity and I'm going to roll it up. And that's just not actually how brains work even. Even though we may have really transposed our own, you know, artifacts onto it by saying, well, that's a hierarchical area that controls this, that, and the other, and it's disconnected from this one that does that thing. And then we sever one connection and we realize how hard it is to make a decision because the emotional center has been cut off from the logical center, right? So that's a lot of metaphors, but I think that
you're losing a lot of non-rational information that is just sort of embodied experience and how I feel about this environment, these people, and this context.
And it turns out that all of that is critical to making good decisions, right?
Surprise, right? Yeah.
It turns out
there's a lot.
Do that, exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
When you stamp out, when you like diminish the nuance and richness of something, there's less there. Yeah, more refined, but less density.
And it becomes more difficult to make the actual decision in actually existing human beings.
Right? Oh, surprise, surprise. It's hard holding like big complexity sets individually. Like the best mm-hmm. you can do is become a node in a network that can hold that map together collectively. So liberating structures have this relationship with complexity in that they came out of the same spaces that appreciative inquiry came out of. I think it was the Telos Institute in the early days of the Santa Fe Institute where the nerds were talking about narrative-based.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, exactly. So these things have sort of been there. And these motherfuckers put together a way of actually proceduralizing a participatory structure and going beyond simple procedural or propositional knowledge successfully. So if you're familiar with John Vervaeke's, right, what I like to do in liberating structures, the best shit is what we do in the Think Slow Dojo, which is all about activating that slow, effortful, conscious intention and attention, which is to use the liberating structures as mm-hmm. a procedure to embody a specific set propositional knowledge around how to activate this state of slow thinking. And so we use these procedures and then to help us get into the state, and then we continuously re-aspectualize the perspectival information. So this is what it's like for me in this state. This is what it's like for you in this state. Again, continuing to re-aspectualize together. And then on top of that, we're doing this in this highly participatory way. So we're doing this way that's sort of like feels like a fucking thing because it is, because it's you and me really doing the goddamn thing together. And so that carries this sort of very interesting vibe that is like really thinking in these distributed ways, like really making sure that it's like we're a node in this distributed network. And the information that I have, you know, easily slots in. I can offer the highest fidelity view of the things that are the most clear for me and only those things, and then drop that into a shared space that enables other people to grab onto it and understand parts of the complexity that they would never even know to look at. Mm-hmm. And together, we can just hold this high resolution map. And then that makes sort of navigating it, you know, relatively trivial when the information is not mine, but truly ours. Like we can look at this together, right? For sure, there's my interest, but like it's also relatively transparent as well because we got a high resolution map.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that can be cool. That can be cool.
And it's not, you know, there are so many other angles to it too, but it's not at least dictated by one or two levels of management hierarchy that tell you what the actual truth of the landscape is, but that can't ever actually get to it, right? And that's not to say that liberating structures or any other approaches gives you any specific, you know, notion of truth, right? It's actually just more about having more accurate maps, right? And then that's kind of the way I've always put it. It's like, say, you can
more richness.
Exactly. More richness, a little bit more accuracy in what the landscape, the phase space that you're navigating together in order to get a particular thing done, whether that's work, whether it's, you know, whatever, relationship, what have you. Cool. So what are you up to now? I know there's an LS DAO, there's a liberating structures DAO. What's going into that? Tell us a bit about that.
So that's two projects primarily. The first one is the most like obvious, which is help everybody in the world, 10 billion people, learn, practice, and use liberating structures. Especially the route that I'm using right now is really through ReFi. I want to help make liberating structures just sort of like synonymous with how we do things in ReFi in the regen space. But you just have like an implicit expectation as people sort of get attracted to the vibe and start to do shit. That, oh, like we do things differently around here. So we're doing event support for the ReFi Spring and for Regens Unite, hosting Regens Unite both here in Berlin on September 16th and 17th. Let me get my motherfucking shilling.
Oh, yeah. No, of course. There's always time for shilling. But when you said here, where is here?
I'm somewhere entirely. I'm in Austria at the Crypto Commons Gathering. We're going to be hosting a week-long unconference, you know, at the intersection of, you know, you guessed it, crypto and commons. A bunch of nerds from the space.
Cool. So then with LS DAO, then you're looking to support, to really focus on the refi space and make sure that these tools are socialized and used by people who are starting DAOs, starting protocols, working on regenerative finance.
Yeah. As we come and hang out in this space, like the more we can make these things normalized, the higher probability we can encourage each other to use them, because that's where these things die. It's really, you know, what's the most comfortable for mode for us to communicate together in. And if it can be, this can be a comfortable mode that everybody's familiar with, then we got a good chance at a win. So, and really spreading these tools. So again, everybody learn, practice, and use liberating structures.
Awesome. And where can people go to stay on? This is your real time to shield now. Where can people go to stay on top of this? Your work, LS DAO, et cetera.
So we're trying to get the word out to Gitcoin and the grants round, of course. And we're trying to get the word out on doing good. We're trying to get the word out on Giveth. We're just trying to get the word out so people know where to find opportunities to practice and support. I mean, there's 10,000 participants in the Liberating Structures community. Like, I am a dude in that community who's doing shit here in Web3. But there's 10,000 participants spread out over the globe, split into like 200 different practice groups. So there's a shared calendar where you can go and find a drop-in practice session to experience these things for an hour, hour and a half, and then take something home and go out and use it. And I host spaces twice a week on Monday, 4 p.m. Central European time, the Wise Crowds design call, where you can come and bring like, hey, I have a meeting, training, like workshop-y thing. How can I use liberating structures to attack that thing? We'll give you advice and give you some stuff that you can go do your homework on and go execute and deliver. And then we host the Think Slow Dojo, which is a more reflective space where we try and get into this like high flow state of distributed cognition, because that's that we look at as like a sort of skill set and a familiarity space, just like playing your scales. Like, we want to get a rep in so that we can drop into exceptional conversation. And then on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock Central European time, we're doing a come give and get help session for the ReFi space. It's for the organizers of ReFi Spring events, but anybody who's got working on anything should come and fucking hang out so that we can just give and get help to each other, like completely cross transversal ReFi regeneration. Just come, go hang out, and I will help create a little hive mind of people that'll help give you advice on whatever that thing is, or, you know, check out this thing you're making.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Jeremy. I think I'll follow up with you too to make sure we get all of those events into the show notes and we can start making sure that people know where this stuff is and promoting it. Awesome. Thanks a lot for your time.
Oh, thank you very much, man. Regensunite.earth, motherfucker. Coming out.
Oh yeah, there you go. And I've been to one Regens Unite event. I believe you guys did one in Amsterdam. It was awesome. It was definitely one of the best sessions with the Taoists. So I highly recommend.
Yep. We hung out, man. I'm dropping to the vibe. Amsterdam and Berlin on the calendar for September.
You heard the man. All right. Thanks, Jeremy.
From Shakalaka Laka. Good hanging out, Jahed. My girl gave me a bowl cutter.